Ryan Dawson of the ANC Report, the Anti-Neocon Report. With me today is a repeat guest. It's been a few years, though. Guillermo Rudolph, a chemist, a scientist with a master's degree, also an author who's written numerous books. I'll just say I can't name them all, but you can see the links below and pick what you are interested in. And recently, he has been transferring a lot of this material from his books on the subjects of World War II, particularly the Holocaust, over to video, and that's been a struggle as well, because we know the censorship that you face, especially on YouTube, when you get into sensitive topics like these. So I will let him answer some questions about what's been going on and update you on his work. Welcome back to the show, Mr. Rudolph. How are you doing?
Thank you. Thank you for having me on. I'm doing fine.
Now, with your books, you've been writing a series on the Holocaust, and recently Amazon has been giving you trouble. Can you explain what's been going on there?
Yes. Well, first of all, I don't write all the books. It's a series that's called the Holocaust Handbook Series, and it's a series that I initiated in 2000 with the first book we labeled as such that was dissecting the Holocaust. I have written a number of books that are part of the series, but there are many more authors, and in particular one author that has contributed the majority. It's the Italian scholar Carlo Mattonio. Now, the series now encompasses 41 books, not all of which have been published yet, but they're in the process. 34 are out by now. They are, some of them are university-style special studies on certain aspects of the Holocaust, certain camps, certain claimed murder weapons, and some of them are more general in nature. And apart from that, we have some other books addressing similar issues that are not part of the series, but some of them are focusing on the Holocaust too, in particular a series that's started with the name Fail. We have now rebranded it to Bungled, where we take books of the mainstream that claim to refute revisionism and then subject them to intense criticism, to refutation, and juxtapose the revisionist argument with their trying to refute us. And that series was designed to be posted primarily on Amazon, because what we realized is that Amazon is highly automatized. So if you create a book that is by title and by subject similar to another book of an opposing view, then people searching for one of the books will automatically find also the other one. So we take advantage of Amazon's search engine to reach readers, to make readers that are looking for certain books aware, or there's another one addressing the same issue but from a different point of view. And that was launched in middle of last year, and we had, after a short while, three books out, and they were very successful. They were placed on Amazon next to the opponents of our views, and they sold at a similar quantity. So it turns out, you know, we have no power to market our books. Neither do we have access to the channels, because we get censored everywhere, nor do we have the financial resources to actually pay for big promotion campaigns. But Amazon, with their automatized search engine and so forth, and automatized packaging of discount deals, of combined purchases, was kind of automatically doing the job for us. So if we have kind of a level playing field, it turned out that revisionist books find a similar interest and clientele as mainstream books on the Holocaust. If censorship is removed and the promotion disadvantages we have is removed too, that turns out to be the case when you're on Amazon. So somewhere alarm bells must have gone off, and we heard that toward the end of last year that there were certain lobby groups screaming bloody murder, that Amazon would offer revisionist or denial book, as they claim them, anti-Semitic books, denial books. They shouldn't do that. They weren't necessarily naming who was involved, but we knew who was being targeted, primarily because of the more recently published books on Holocaust revisionism by revisionists. I would say we, that is Castle Publishers, do a vast majority of them, maybe 90% of the books, revisionist books nowadays published, are published by us. So we knew we are the target. Nothing happened late last year because we've had that before. Amazon so far was steadfast in following Bezos' motto to offer the good, the bad, and the ugly and not censor anyone and let people make up their own mind. But that then was bound to change in earlier of this year, in March. Then Yad Vashem, the Israeli Holocaust Memorial and Research Center, in combination with the Board of Deputies of British Jews, were initiating a press campaign asking Amazon to withdraw denial and anti-Semitic books. And they named in the context Arthur Butz's Hopes of the 20th Century, which is in a new edition part of our Holocaust Handbook series.
Which is not anti-Semitic, and it's not full-on denial either.
Yeah, well, it all depends on definition, but there's an interesting aspect to the anti-Semitic thing that I'll get later to. And then there were two others, like Harwood's Did 6 Million Really Die, and some other older book, I can't remember anymore what it was, that was mentioned, that is not part of any of our series, and it's a very outdated, very old publication, a classic, but not really of any concern because it doesn't sell and it doesn't exist in really large quantities and new editions. Well, I may be mistaken, Did 6 Million Really Die was issued in a new edition. Be that as it may, our series was not directly mentioned, and of the 40 books or 34 that are published by now, and the other was there's some more than 40 that we had in our program, only the hoax was mentioned. Then in early March, we received a notification by Amazon Kindle, the ebook subsidiary of Amazon, that they block some 60 or 70 of our books that we had in our account with them. We have some 100 plus books in the account, and they blocked 75 of them for alleged violation of content guidelines, inappropriate content. And Amazon's content guidelines are very general. I said something to the effect, well, we don't accept offensive material, and what we consider offensive is what any reasonable person would consider as offensive, and that's all I say. So that's kind of a catch-it-all phrase, so you can throw in there whatever they please. Uh-huh. And a day later, their print-on-demand subsidiary, CreateSpace, sent us a similar notification that of the 100-plus books we had in their account for the hard copy production, they took 75 offline and blocked the ISBN numbers. And then I was actually researching matters, what's going on. I found out that pretty much at the same point, Barnes & Noble had blocked the same ISBN numbers. So they didn't just delete or block the production files in the print-on-demand books subsidiary they had, but they blocked the ISBN numbers as such on Amazon. So if you type in their shortcut with the ISBN number, a 404 page doesn't exist notification would come up on the screen. Amazon has these cute dogs that they show, sorry, can't find it. And that wasn't happened just with our books that were from the Holocaust Handbook series and some other one in addition to those, but with all prior editions that had ever appeared of any older books, like Hoax of the 20th Century. I mentioned that book's first edition came out in 76, and there was a second one in 77. They had a slightly expanded one with a few appendixes in the 80s, and then another one in the late 80s or early 90s. And then I had one in 2003. That was the first one as part of our series, an updated and expanded edition. All the ISBN numbers, all of them were blocked. So it is as if you go to Amazon and look for Hoax of the 20th Century, the book has never existed. So you couldn't even put up there a used copy of it for sale with the Amazon Marketplace because the ISBN number was just blocked. Of course, you can put it up without an ISBN number, but even some books that had been posted without ISBN numbers that were secondhand copies, they got blocked. And with another few other revisionist classics not in our program, the similar fate happened. Now, interestingly, Not all books of all our Holocaust Handbook series are even about the Second World War, quote unquote, Holocaust. That is to say, the claimed attempt by the National Socialist regime to exterminate the Jews. We have in particular two books in there that have nothing to do with that particular aspect of history. One is Don Hedesheimer's The First Holocaust, which talks about
First War.
Time-wise, it's focused around the First World War and the time right after it, and it focuses on the question of where did the 6 million number originate. So it looks back in history, and it stops at the timeline roughly in the mid-1920s, late 1920s, and doesn't go any further. So it has nothing to do with Second World War history, let alone the Holocaust that's supposed to have happened there. And then there's another one by German scholar Ingrid Weckert about Jewish immigration from the Third Reich during peacetime. So it talks about how Jews emigrated from Germany between 1933 to 1939, pretty much the outbreak of the war, and I think the first couple of war years too, when the National Socialist regime was promoting that Jews under their reign in their sphere of influence would emigrate, and they were assisting, implementing a policy of ethnic pressure, as you would nowadays maybe say, by making the lives miserable, but on the other hand, giving them all the assistance they could, financially included, to leave the country. So that has nothing directly to do with the Holocaust in terms of extermination either. But these two books were blocked as well. It shows you that the Yad Vashem and or the Board of Deputies in England must have given Amazon a wash list of certain titles they had to take out, and included were indiscriminately all the titles of the Holocaust Handbook series that had been wiped out. In the media after that, there was a short reference, now Amazon has blocked denial and anti-Semitic literature. And these three books, then came again hoax, and did 6 million really die, and something else. That's all I said. Three books were blocked. When in our account alone, there were over 70, and then I looked on Amazon, the victims of censorship reached beyond our own program. There were others that had been censored, even though they were a minority. But all in all, I came up with some, I think well over 100 titles that had been wiped off clean, and they were no longer available. So the media were downplaying the massive scale on which Amazon had taken down this literature. Now, if you go online on Amazon and look for books like Mein Kampf by Adolf Hitler or The Myth of the 20th Century by Alfred Rosenberg and other literature, and also the Portals of the Elders of Zion, you'll find them. They were not blocked. Now, this is the classic considered anti-Semitic literature out there, and other books that were published during the Third Reich year, The Jew as a Criminal, and there's a lot of materials all there. So this was not targeted against anti-Semitic National Socialist ideological literature, because you can still have it. It's all there. It was particularly targeted against our series, our failed, respectively, bungled series, because it was so successful, and our Holocaust Handbook series, because it was such a big intellectual threat with its university-style research that was debunking and refuting the mainstream Holocaust narrative. And so from a Jewish perspective, or a Zionist perspective, I should say, it's not necessarily Jewish, but it's definitely Zionist, they had to do something. When we found out that we can instrumentalize Amazon by picking the right title of our books and placing them properly, so that Amazon's automatic feature of search engine and bundling books that are bought together at discounts would play in our advantage, we were so successful that had that gone on, it would have turned out that there is a level playing field between revisionists and the orthodoxy, and more people would have come to know the revisionist argument, appreciate it, and assume it to be at least legitimate, if not correct. And that would have been a major disaster, because that's the end of the dominance of the Holocaust narrative. The only way to stop it was censorship, and that's why they put the thumb screws on Amazon and made them take it down. And after so many years of Amazon ignoring them, they finally caved in and did what they thought they had to do.
You see a similar thing online, like with YouTube and other social media sites, where actual anti-Semitic stuff, I mean straight up pure kill the Jews type of stuff, you can find that. You can find Wahhabism online, you know, talking about killing certain ethnic groups and stuff in Syria and so on. But that's left there. That's left on Facebook, too. You can say whatever you want. They're not afraid of that. That's the kind of that's the boogeyman they want to have. They want to point to some ardent racist, because that's easy to deal with. They look like a moron. They don't want to deal with actual arguments. And it seems for the common person, though, I'll let you explain this. People wonder, if you're writing about the Holocaust, they assume, wrongly, but they're assuming, what's the motivation to do that other than anti-Semitism? Why would you want to say fewer than 6 million died, or you know, any part of it, any exaggeration that was ever made during any war? This is the one you're not allowed to talk about legally in some places, but what would motivate anyone to write about it unless they're prejudiced? This seems to be the common view for people who don't pay a lot of attention to this stuff.
Well, yes, because they assume right from the start that there is no merit to such a quote-unquote extreme stance on the topic, because they assume, you know, everything has been proven a million times, the whole world believe in it. It's as idiotic as thinking that the earth is flat. So why would anyone have a motivation if it's obvious that it's wrong and mendacious? And that's just the false premise they're starting off from. You know, if they opened their mind and looked into the evidence, they would find out that the evidentiary ground is very shaky, to say the least, and that there's plenty of reason to be critical about the Orthodox narrative. And the reason why I, in particular, have been doing what I've been doing over the past quarter of a century, pretty much, is not because I want it. It's not a very pleasant topic to begin with, and I'd rather spend my time doing something that gets me onto a nice career and gives me a high reputation status in society. It's much more pleasant prospect. But the issue here is simply a matter of, for me, a matter of justice and a matter of insisting on my right as a human being to doubt, to express my doubt, to search for the truth, and to be able to express what I think I found out. And if I'm then being persecuted and prosecuted for this very profoundly human activity, you know, my humanity gets trampled under and gets destroyed and threatened by the government and by society. And this is just then a matter of justice. You know, as a human, I have a right to do these things. And if you deny me those, you deny me my humanity. And any person, I think, on this planet has the obligation to resist such governmental or societal intrusion or infringement on our human rights, to doubt, to search for the truth, and to communicate what we think we've found, as long as we're peaceful in the way we're doing it.
It also seems to be uniquely about that war. You can, well, maybe a little bit the American Civil War, those two. But you can talk about World War One. You can talk about, in recent times, all the lies and deceptions about the war in Iraq, the ongoing conflict in Syria, about gassings in Syria, who did what and how many people died, and so on. You can criticize that, and you'll get the normal level of resistance to people who disagree or whatever, but you're not going to go to jail, and no one's going to think you're like a flat earther.
Right.
But in World War II, to question any aspect of the Holocaust means you're an anti-Semitic Nazi who, you know, who denies the moon landing or something.
Right. Even that comparison, you know, if you say, what other motivation can you have than anti-Semitism? That can be turned around against those people making that accusation. Mm-hmm. Because there is no other topic where being critical and being oppositional, if you wish, or going against the established version is more suppressed, persecuted, and prosecuted in many countries. Even you can, when it comes to history, you can doubt anything you want, and almost everyone on this planet, about almost or basically every topic, will shrug their shoulders and think, "So what? He's entitled to do it, and if he likes to do it, let him go ahead." It's only this one topic where all the buttons are pushed and the levers are being pulled in order to stop critical people, stop skeptics from doing what they're doing. I mean, it's unique in the history of mankind that people are being thrown in prison for disagreeing with the government on a certain subtopic of a certain era in history.
It's only one side of the half the war, the Pacific theater.
Right.
I want to argue about how many people died in the bombings in Japan, whether I go more than the set amount or less than the set amount. I'm not going to prison.
Right.
But, you know, in Poland, I can, or I could if I lived in the wrong place. It's unbelievable how protected it is, and I would argue that level of sacredness and protection on a topic actually causes more people to doubt it.
Because I'd hope so. Because
you're allowed to have inquiry about, and the facts can stand on their own.
That's right. Here again, you know, we need to ask for the motives. Why are governments, why are pressure groups, why are lobby groups implementing that kind of policy that is completely unique, to suppress any dissent and throw them in prison with no defense allowed? I mean, this is another aspect that people don't realize. And I've spoken in Germany, of all places where people should know, because they have the instruments to find out, to highly educated people, PhD educated people. And they say, well, you've been on trial, people go on trial for this. Well, present your evidence. You can defend yourself. You know, that's a country under the rule of law. And if you have the better argument, you should prevail in court. They don't realize that you're not allowed, under threat of further punishment, to even ask for the introduction of evidence, let alone present it. It's because if you do that, supporting your case, you would, in court, by doing so, again, violate the dogma and violate the law that says you are not allowed to doubt, you're not allowed to refute, to deny, and if you present evidence with the aim of doing that in a public session of a courtroom, it's a crime. So
and
lawyers,
just a lawyer too.
Right, a lawyer just asking a court to introduce evidence to the effect that the defendant's views are correct gets the lawyer indicted and thrown in prison, again, without the lawyer having a right to defend himself. So we have a situation in Germany and in basically pretty much all the other countries that have outlawed it, even though they weren't quite as sophisticated in codifying it, but the effect is the same. You have no right to defense. We have had court cases in Canada and in Australia where it's not even a crime, but with the so-called human rights commissions they have there, where it's a civil proceedings, but then they give an order what you have to do, take down your website, don't utter an opinion anymore that's considered offensive. If you don't follow that order, then you are in violation of the law because you disobey the order of an authority.
You'll also lose.
So you end up going in jail.
The social consequences, because
right.
No
in
matter
these cases,
what you're saying, if you say it's 5 million instead of 6, that's denial, and
well, it depends on
your
how
job.
It depends on how you do it. I mean, there are some scholars like Reitlinger and Hilbeck who have themselves said it weren't 6, but 5, maybe, or even only 5, 4.
Right, Raul Hilberg wrote it like that, but I think he said 5.5.
Well, first of all, these are all Jews, so they get away with more. And secondly, they embed it in the context of describing it very, very negatively for Nazi Germany, and therefore that's acceptable. If you phrase it differently and you're not a Jew, you get in trouble much easier. But as I said, even in Canada and in Australia, in those human rights commissions, they clearly stated, when in Canada it was Ernst Zundel, in Australia it was Frederick Taubman, both of them wanted to introduce evidence to support their views. It was stated, truth is not a defense. If a statement is offensive, no matter whether it's true or not, if a certain minority considered it offensive, and that minority has leverage, of course, in the power structure of a country, then it cannot be expressed. Now, if you're a majority, like you're a white Anglo-Saxon majority in a country, and you're offended by something that doesn't help you, like Germans can't resort to any legal measures if they are being insulted as Nazis and this and that by the whole world, and bad luck. You're a majority, you need to put up with this. So truth is no defense. And it's no defense in all the countries that have outlawed it in one way or another. Therefore, there is no way of getting our word in any official way. Or the only way we have is trying to get books and documentaries and so forth out there and place them in the market place of ideas and hope that we're not getting censored. But then again, if we are not, we turn out to be successful and then the censors hit again. I've been through that a number of times. The Amazon censorship was only the last step in this process. We have had similar devastating effects, like credit card processing companies like Visa and Master denying services, and Amazon has closed accounts before on a different. We had marketplace accounts that was closed down, and that's a process we are kind of used to. Revisionism faces this issue over and over again. I've been in it now for 25 years, and I've seen it for 25 years happen. We get our act together, we produce something, we are convincing, we're making success headway, we are gaining the attention of some part of the mainstream, they take us seriously. Boom, comes either persecution, prosecution, censorship in any form you can imagine to cut us down, to destroy our success. And then we have to start over.
PayPal will shut you off too. And every method ever of getting any kind of money. And it's just baffling to me because, you know, I mean, labor camps and starvation and shootings and all that's bad enough. There's no reason to exaggerate it. It's still going to be bad. Like, the story will still be kind of the same. This is a sacred thing because World War II and, you know, creating new Hitlers is the justification for every war after it. It's the epitome of evil of any example anywhere in any college campus or high school classroom when they want to give an example of the bad guys. It's what if the Nazis fill in the blank? Because that's just the unquestioned evil. And I'm not saying it was good, but I'm saying that is the protected word. It's replaced Satan and demons. Like, you could... if you held a sign outside that said fuck God or something like that, some people would look at you weird or whatever, but if you wrote fuck the Jews, you'd go to jail. I'm not saying you should have either sign, but you see what triggers people more. And it's really, you've done this new film on the chemistry in Auschwitz, and what you were saying about this kind of bully process, the way these groups bullied Amazon and bully these companies and into censorship, it's really grown, and especially in science. I mean, we're at a point now where there obviously are two genders, and yet because these cry bullies whine enough, even in universities, and you're just not allowed to have a contrary opinion, they just want to have multiple genders. They make up new ones all the time. And they roll over and allow these bullies to do this in science. I mean, it's not scientific. It's totally a political issue. But they're just going to ignore biology and science and make up genders. And so I just want people – I'm using this as an example. Like, when you can do that, you can certainly bully people on chemical analysis on walls at Auschwitz or something, because we can't even get people to admit there are two genders anymore. And that is the degree of cuckery that we are facing in the scientific community and universities, even in the United States, which relative to the rest of the world is pretty free.
Absolutely correct.
So I want to ask you about this new film. Now, this was the film version of what had already been written, and it's The Chemistry at Auschwitz. I watched it a few days ago, and I get pretty deep into this stuff, but not like this. I've never had it laid out like that in a film. And I think this is a wonderful new medium if you can, you know, keep them online somehow. And I encourage everybody to see that. I'd like to break down some of the arguments in there. People want to talk about gas chambers. That's part of one big, huge part of the Holocaust, is gassing and throwing people into ovens. The question that revisionists say is, why are there leftover stains, Prussian blue stains, from delousing chambers, but not the gas chambers? And there's a lot of rationales. Could it be weather? Could it just been time? But if that's the case, why would it survive in one area and not the other? And they have their own chemists that have gone in and gotten the results they were forced to find. But if you could you break down some of the non-revisionist arguments that the best evidence for gas chambers and why at Auschwitz, not talking about anywhere else, just Auschwitz for now, and why revisionists disagree?
Yes. We're talking about my own chemical analysis, which I made, as I mentioned, 25 years ago. That's the way I got into this. And just for the reader or for the listener, a short introduction of what the issue is. The chemical said to have been used to mass murder Jews at Auschwitz is called Zyklon B. That may ring a bell for a lot of listeners. Zyklon B is just a trade name, or was, I should say. And the active ingredient in it is hydrogen cyanide, which is at room temperature. It's a liquid, but it evaporates very quickly. It has a low boiling point. And this hydrogen cyanide can interact with rust contained in masonry. Now, rust is a natural component of sand and cement, the basic ingredients you use to make a mortar and plaster and cement and concrete. And so you have a certain amount of around 1-2%, 3% of rust in every masonry material that's around you in a wall. And if you expose that to gaseous hydrogen cyanide, then there is a chance that a reaction between the hydrogen cyanide and the rust takes place, leading to a blue pigment that's called Prussian blue or iron blue. And we know for a fact that this reaction has happened in a number of places. The Third Reich, in many of its labor and concentration camps, had delousing chambers. Lice are doing wartime, in particular, a major issue where people are crowded together, be that in military barracks or in labor camps, in prisoner of war camps, concentration camps, where the hygienic conditions are anything else but ideal. So lice spread, and lice can transfer typhus, which has caused many epidemics throughout history, and in particular during the First World War, and was feared to do the same, and did actually do the same again during the Second World War, when a lot of German labor and concentration camps typhus epidemics broke out and killed a lot of people. So to prevent lice from spreading, they had these delousing chambers. They used Zyklon B, which by definition was a fumigant, a pest control agent. They didn't have the sophisticated chemicals we have today, but they used hydrogen cyanide for it to kill lice. Of course, it's also deadly for humans. And in those delousing chambers, the ones that have survived the war, a lot of them were torn down after the war, but some of them survived, we find blue stains on the wall. I show that in my book. The new edition of my expert report on this issue is called The Chemistry of Auschwitz. It was available on Amazon until a couple of weeks ago. Now they've taken that down too, because it was actually published after the big censorship sweep. So I got that out a couple of weeks later, and it was on, and they found out about it a couple of weeks ago, and they took it down. But if you just Google it instead of going to Amazon, you Google it, The Chemistry of Auschwitz by Gemma Rudolf, you'll find it. And you also find it always on holocausthandbooks.com. It's there also as a free download, so you don't have to pay for it. You just go there, get an ebook, PDF, or Kindle, and you're good to go. But you can also get it as a hard copy. Now, I made a documentary out of it, and in this documentary with the same title, which is still available and accessible on YouTube for now, even though they have blocked it in European countries for legal reasons, but not in the US.
I have made a backup of it on Vimeo, just in case.
Very good, yeah. And it's also on holocausthandbooks.com. We have our own copy there. there you can see the footage that shows all the blue stains of all of the places that I was managed to get footage and pictures from. So it's really patchy blue, intensely blue colored walls. Now, in Auschwitz, there are a number of locations where people are said to have been murdered using the same Zyklon B. And these walls have no blue stains, and samples taken and analyzed have shown that they have basically no residues of cyanides, that is to say, of this Prussian blue either. Basically means if we take sample from somewhere else, we get the same readings. Now, my first edition, I made a footnote about that, that it's not quite clear whether very low readings close to the detection limit are actually reliable or not, because I couldn't reproduce them. So I said there's a question there, and I spoke to the laboratories, to the experts in analytic chemistry on cyanide, and they clearly indicated we have these solid samples. Our analytical methods were geared toward liquid samples, so it's not necessarily the same reliability. So there was already a question over the issue of the very low readings, if any, that could be found in what is claimed to have been homicidal gas chamber, whether that has any meaning at all. Then a couple of years after I did my research, a Polish team did a similar study. They were researchers from the Janssen Institute at Krakow, which is a institute run under the aegis of the Polish Ministry of Justice. So it's basically a government agency doing forensic research in crime cases. And as such, it is subject to the orders of the Polish government, which is a problem because the Polish government doesn't allow, quote unquote, denying the Holocaust. So the researchers legally could not come up with a conclusion that gassings at Auschwitz didn't take place, because that would have violated Polish law. And so you see the whole setup was already a problem. An agency, part of the Polish government, which outlaws certain results, to what result would they come?
Yeah.
Then they were asked to do their research by the Polish Auschwitz Museum, which is a state museum of Auschwitz, which is, again, a subsidiary of the Polish government. Mm-hmm. So there's the Polish government ordering another subsection of the Polish government to do research in a framework of the law allowing only one result of that research. What would you expect? So the result was, of course, that they, in their final statement, confirmed gassings took place because we find similar amounts in homicidal gas chambers as we find in delousing chambers, which is exactly the opposite of what I have found. I found, to give an order of magnitude here, 1,000 to 10,000 milligrams per kilogram in samples in the delousing chambers of this Prussian blue, whereas I found nothing to only a few milligrams in homicidal gas chambers or in other locations that are not connected to either homicidal gas chambers or delousing chambers.
The fact that there are delousing chambers,
the results were extremely contradictory, and the question is, what's going on here? Now,
well, we'll back up a little bit.
The argument of
why delouse people at a
the polls who did that research and the people they quoted in their support went along the line that humans are much more susceptible, much more sensitive to hydrogen cyanide than lice are, meaning that you need less amounts of poison for a shorter period of time to kill a human being than you need to kill a louse, in particular at cooler temperature when the metabolism of the louse is very slow, and taking into consideration that you also want to kill the eggs of the lice that are already enclosed in whatever you're fumigating, and the eggs have extremely slow metabolism, so you need to, you want to kill those too, and you need to expose them to several hours, whereas with humans you can achieve a certain death result already after a minute or even less with even less concentration. That is the claim. And when I was working on my expert report before the polls came into the picture, I already knew about those arguments that were made by an Austrian chemist that the polls later relied on too, saying, well, it takes much less, and the germs use low amounts, low concentrations. And I was taking that seriously then and was looking into it. And if you go to expert literature on the toxicology of hydrogen cyanide, you find indeed that humans, according to their data, die at certain concentrations already very quickly, within a minute or even less. It says something like instantly or almost instantly. Taking that, it looks like the opponents of revisionists are right. You can apply very little amounts for a very short period of time, and that could explain why in the homicidal gas chamber we find very little, if any, of the hydrogen cyanide residues in terms of Prussian blue. And the problem was, when I was going after that literature and compared it with the only set of reliable, documented cases we know about killings, executions of humans with hydrogen cyanide, these two sets of data didn't match. And I'm talking here about homicidal executions in the United States. There are a number of states in the United States who, since the 1920s, have introduced executions using hydrogen cyanide in gas chambers. And until the end of the 20th century, several hundred executions had been performed that way, and then the method was kind of abandoned as cruel and unusual punishment. But there's a study out now that came out in 2010 or 2011, which I've included in my new study, that has a lot of data about how long it takes at what kind of concentration to kill humans. And if you compare this data, set of data, on the only reality supported cases we know of killing humans, it shows clearly, even with relatively high concentrations of the poison gas, it takes on average 10 minutes to kill humans. And in an extreme case, the longest lasting execution actually took 18 minutes to have the defendant declared dead, or the executee, I should say. Whereas the expert literature on the same topic stated clearly already at lower concentrations than what is used or was used in U.S. execution gas chambers, people die after short instances, less than a minute. So that didn't make much sense. Now, the side opposing revisionism, the mainstream scholars relied on the expert literature with a good reason, because that's just what you do. And not necessarily on the experiences the United States has gathered during their gas chamber executions, because it wasn't all that well documented before that book came out in 2010 that I mentioned by Scott Christensen called The Last Gasp, where all the data about U.S. executions is contained. Now, interestingly, just when I started revising my book and planning on doing the documentary, Italian scholar Carlo Mattonia sent me a publication that had been released not too long ago. It was initially categorized as secret by Edgewood Wood Arsenal, it's a research institute of the U.S. Armed Forces for Chemical Warfare. The subsection for Department for Chemical Warfare or something like that, and they made a study on how toxic hydrogen cyanide actually is for human beings in the context of chemical warfare. They wanted to know how much do we have to apply so people, soldiers, not having a gas mask on, inhale enough of it before they manage to put their gas mask on so that they would die with certainty. That was the task. So they wanted certain death within a short period of time. They needed to really figure out what's going on. And the researcher who was doing that project also first took the expert literature and found, it goes very quickly. But then he found a literature from 1936, a research study, where they had made an experiment putting a human volunteer and a dog together in an experimental gas chamber in a laboratory, exposing them to the same kind of concentration of hydrogen cyanide at the same time and observing them. And interestingly, the dog, it's mid-sized dog, died after only 1.5 minutes, or rather, I should say, he became unconscious and stopped breathing. And the human volunteer at that point did not have even shown any symptoms at all. And this, taken together with other material, it clearly indicates that humans are much less susceptible than smaller mammals. And then the guy actually who did the 1976 Edward Arsenal study tracked down expert literature. Expert literature that handbooks on certain topics, they contain a lot of information. If we talk about handbooks on toxicology, they contain a lot of information about a lot of substances. Hydrogen cyanide is only a very small sub-chapter in a section there. And, of course, they don't, these experts editing and writing these books, they don't... They cannot rely on personal experiments and data they gathered on all substances, but they quote it from somewhere. And he tracked down what these people in expert literature, German as well as American expert literature, had actually quoted, and tracked it down to a source of a German book published in 1919 referring to experiments done in Germany prior to the First World War that was done using rabbits. So the data you find in toxicology literature to this day is not referring to the sensitivity of humans to hydrogen cyanide, but rabbits. And I've actually footage in my documentary where a test gassing is performed in an American gas chamber, I think it's in Mississippi, with rabbits. And you see there that in the American execution gas chambers, the executee is engulfed by the toxic fumes right after the execution has started. You see the mist rising, and the rabbits in that particular case die within not even a minute. So rabbits are really highly susceptible to this poison, whereas humans obviously are not, because all the experience with U.S. gas chamber execution shows with the same kind of concentration, same kind of method, same kind of setup and machinery, humans on average take 10 minutes, and in extreme cases, even up to 80 minutes to die. And I just referred to the dog having become unconscious and stopped breathing. And they took him out of the chamber because they thought he was dead. And minutes later, he recovered, jumped off, and ran away. So even if somebody is unconscious and stopped breathing, you can't be sure that they're actually really dead. You have to wait for a while, still exposing them to the poison, because they may come back and start breathing again. And because hydrogen cyanide poisonings are reversible. So our bodies have methods of detoxifying themselves to some degree. It's a slow process, but it can be done. And so if you gas somebody, it's unconscious, stop breathing, you can't just stop them, take them out of the chamber and think everything's done, because, you know, you pile them up in front of a crematorium thinking they're dead, and few of them come back to life and run away. Not good. So you wait a little longer. All this said, it is clear now, and I've shown that in my documentary and my book, that the assumptions you need very low concentrations to kill people quickly are incorrect. We know now with all the data we have that you need high concentrations and an extended period of time to make sure that really everybody is with certainty dead. And that's what the task the military has if they want to kill soldiers in the field, the enemy, or the Nazis are said to have had if they wanted to kill the Jews in the gas chambers. And that all put together then confirms my assumptions that, no, if the Nazis wanted to do what they are said to have been done, they needed to use similar concentrations as were used in delousing chambers, and needed an extended period of time, not necessarily as long as in delousing chambers, but maybe only one order of magnitude lower, which then is compensated by other chemical factors, like we're talking about underground morgues where the gassings are said to have happened, which would have been moist and cool. And moist and cool masonry tends much more toward accumulation and formation of the Prussian blue we're talking. I'm not going into details here. Put in a nutshell.
It's all in the film, though.
Basically, we have to expect similar amounts of Prussian blue, the blue staining, in the homicidal gas chambers as we find them in the delousing chambers, if what is claimed about those gassings is indeed true. Now, that's very well sourced and referenced and backed up with material that I'm certain now is pretty much no way around that assumption. That refutes what the other side has said about these things in order to explain. Now, coming back to the Poles, as I said, they came up with a result, there's a similar amount to be found in homicidal gas chambers as there can be found in delousing chambers. Therefore, they must have had the same history. Since we know delousing chambers were used intensely, the homicidal gas chambers must have been used this way too. Interestingly, if you look into what the Poles have done, they actually rigged their method. They were faced with a problem that whatever they do, they want to come up with the result that was prescribed by law and expectation and right from the start. So how do they avoid the obvious outcome of any proper analysis that the delousing chambers are chock full of Prussian blue, whereas there's nothing basically in the homicidal gas chambers? Well, you pick a research method and an analytical method that gives you the result you want, a similar result. That is to say, in that case, they picked a method that cannot detect the Prussian blue. Now, as crazy as it sounds, that's exactly what they did. And they had a reasoning for that. And they said, well, the Prussian blue patches on that wall, that may be wall paint. So the Nazis may have gone and painted the interior and exterior and the inside of the walls patchily blue with some blue color. And in order to avoid measuring this artifact, which is actually paint, we exclude these long-term stable iron cyanide compounds called Prussian blue.
He's the same kind of paint on all the
years after the event. You couldn't expect anything to survive but stuff that is long-term stable, but stuff that is so resilient to environmental influences as this material is proven to be. So it was clear if they train their instrument on an object trying to measure something that this instrument is unable to measure, they wouldn't measure anything in any case. So they would always get similar results. So they did that, looking in the delousing chambers, basically didn't find anything. Looked at the homicidal gas chambers, basically didn't find anything either. And I said, well, see, similar results, therefore it must have had a similar history. Completely crazy. There's a lot of evidence clearly indicating that what we are looking at, the patchy blue wall discolorations in the delousing chambers, cannot be wall paint, cannot possibly be wall paint. First of all, the Nazis wouldn't have been crazy to apply just and exclusively in these rooms of all their concentration camp buildings and labor camp buildings and whatever, just in these rooms, blue wall paint. Why? Secondly, there is not even a blue wall paint as such that consists of Prussian blue, because Prussian blue is not stable on freshly plastered walls. Thirdly, you find this pigment not just on the surface, as it would be if it were paint, but you find it inside the wall, inside in the mortar between the bricks. You find it on the outside. It is, the whole wall is penetrated with this stuff. And there's just no way of having the blue wall paint penetrate the whole wall if you just apply it with a brush on the outside or on the inside in that case. Next, paint consists only to a very low percentage of pigment. Most people don't realize it has a lot of binding agents and other chemicals in there that make up the paint as such, give it a nice gloss, hold it together, hold it in place, hold the pigment in place and stabilize it, and. So if you're looking for pigment, if you want to exclude that there is a pigment on there, you would look for these chemicals and say, okay, is there, is there not? Of course, the Poles didn't do that. They just assumed, oh, it may be, and because it may be. And also they said, because we can't explain how Prussian blue would form, we don't understand it, therefore we exclude it. Did nothing to understand, did nothing to verify whether there is paint or not, which clearly there isn't for the reasons given. And I have already proven in my first edition of Expert Report and Literature, before the Poles even started, that the way how Prussian blue can form when hydrogen cyanide reacts with masonry, with rust in masonry. All the chemistry, it's not rocket science, it's basic chemistry that every medium educated chemist can easily understand. And it's laid out there, and they even quoted a book where I laid it out, but they quoted it only as an example of the evil deniers wanting to whitewash Hitler or something to that effect. And I didn't say it in a report, but later in a correspondence they hinted at that that's why they quoted it. But they ignored completely any arguments to the contrary. And that's the hallmark, not of a scientist, but of an ideologue. And scientist has to primarily, if you start research, you look who has done research already on a topic. And then if you find their results, you don't agree with them, you refute them, argue against them. And in particular, you need to quote expert literature on the topic that deals with it. Basic things. Oh, we're talking about chemistry of hydrogen cyanide interacting with masonry. Let's look up literature. What do they say about it? You look at their paper, nothing. They don't quote anything. There's no chemical reference to it. They just say, oh, we don't understand how it could have formed. All right, if you don't understand what you're doing, stay out of it.
Right.
It's that simple. if you want to get involved in research of a topic, get an understanding of it, research it, understand it, and then go forward. So if you just look at their approach, completely unscientific, ideological, and then they pick a method that needed to, by definition, yield a result that they could interpret in an outrageous way, the way they needed to by law in Poland, it's clearly that this was a big fraud, nothing else. But that's what the mainstream nowadays relies upon, because that's their only research series that they have that they could say that refutes revisionism, but it's a fraud.
Since Amazon's given you so many problems and YouTube is sort of, we both know, temporary, where's the best place people can watch the film about Auschwitz, the chemicals analysis at Auschwitz, and where can they get these books?
Well, as I mentioned before, holocausthandbooks.com, these two words put together, and that .com is where you can find all the books of that series, that book on the chemistry of Auschwitz included, and also that documentary and other documentaries. You can download them there. The documentaries as MP4s, high definition or low, whichever you need them. You can even download them as high definition and burn them on a DVD and watch them on a TV. And the books, most of them are available as free downloads, PDF and e-books, Kindle. Some of them are commercial projects where we have to pay royalties and you can't get them. But The Chemistry of Auschwitz is available as a free download. Can be purchased there. Or you'll find links, actually. It's not a sales website, but you can find links to book finder services that lists you all the online stores that offer the book at which price and can get the best deal there. If you want it, The Chemistry of Auschwitz is available as a color edition, which is a little bit more expensive, but it's also available as a black and white edition, which is more affordable if you want to have a hard copy.
I think the color is good for some of the graphs inside, though.
Yeah, that's true.
Worth it for me. Well, I appreciate your time, and you're welcome back anytime as well. People are going to call you a denier and an anti-Semite no matter what you do anyway, so you just got to roll with it sometimes.
Yeah, well, my book and the documentary, as well as what I've been talking about over the past hour, as you heard, I'm not talking about Jews. I mean, they are victims this way or that, but this is about forensics, this is about science, and it's about the politics involved to some degree. Semitism, anti-Semitism, pro-Semitism, it's just not part of the equation.
Well, with the Polish team's methods, you could test the room I'm in right now and get equivalent readings as the Laotian and gas chambers.
Which proves that you're an anti-Semite because you have been gassing Jews for years and years.
In my room, right.
Right. Yeah, probably gassed that too.
Yeah, everybody is the claim, right? Not just Jews. Gas all the prisoners. Yeah, it's something else. It's the most taboo topic I know of. I deal with a lot of them. And I don't think there is anything, not even religion, nothing that is as taboo as talking about the Holocaust.
Absolutely.
I've never been censored more or attacked more vehemently than when I get into these topics. And the fact that they still throw people in prison over such things is just, it's a human rights violation, it's atrocious, and all it really does is add doubt to the entire thing.
Yeah. For those who have a critical mind, and unfortunately, most people go along with government persecution. I've experienced in Germany myself because I've been the victim, and then, you know, I get a house search, and then the media say that there has been a house search at a place where there is a Nazi, living a Nazi, and he has a Nazi bookstore, and blah, blah, blah. There is no Nazi. I had no bookstore, but that's what the media portray me as. And then starting with my landlord and people in the vicinity and the community, they buy that wholesale. And I get thrown out because I'm untenable as a tenant. They don't talk to me anymore. No, but you know, neighbors' kids can't play with my kids anymore because we're just evil. And so it goes on. So unfortunately, people don't realize the mechanism of persecution. They are actually part and parcel of it. Only a few people who are critical enough and who have high standards of human rights and civil rights understand that this is wrong, no matter whether you agree with somebody, is if that if an opinion is peaceful, a person shouldn't be persecuted for it. But they assume I'm not peaceful. You know, you stick a label Nazi on somebody, that's the definition of a person that is violent and genocidal, and then they assume you're really a dangerous person. And it's so easy to actually put someone in a social quarantine, isolating completely from society, but just sticking that one label on you. And you're a pariah and a leper of society, and that's the end.
Just from talking to you and David Cole, Eric Hunt, you know, just a few of you guys, I had the Huffington Post, BBC Watch, and magazines, etc., writing about me, called me a Nazi, said that Jews are cannibals and serial rapists. Like, what are you talking about?
Jesus.
I've probably disproportionately had more Jewish people on my show than any other group. I didn't even realize that because I don't care. When I got accused of this stuff, I go, oh, let me look, and I found that out. It's something else, but they just, if someone screams Nazi, right nowadays, though, I think it's been overused with Antifa and all these groups. They call everybody a Nazi. Like, if you don't agree with them on what president they wanted, you're a Nazi. You know, if you don't agree with them on right. what the smallest little thing, you're a Nazi. And
it's the ideological wonder weapon, a miracle weapon. I'm not going to give up on it. And I don't think it will wear out. I hope it will at some point, but I don't see it coming.
It's not worn out, but it's really reduced in power from, say, even 10 years ago. Because nowadays, when someone calls someone a Nazi, people just roll their eyes and go, well, are they really a Nazi, or they're just not a leftist? I mean, because they're just saying it about anybody. And so it's starting to lose its oomph that it used to have, because that's, like, the worst thing. And it's like calling someone a rapist. I mean, even if you completely exonerate yourself, getting called a Nazi or getting called a racist or sexist or something like that, any of these isms, especially in American culture, it would have been better if you had assaulted somebody with your fist than to hold such an ideological belief, because that is just the epitome of evil. And I'm not saying it's not a bad thing, but it is just the worst. And that label, they can sling it around without consequence. If you accuse someone and you call them a Nazi and they're not, nothing happens to the person doing the accusing, even though you could cause someone to lose their job, cause someone a lot of trouble in their life just by saying the word.
Yeah, it's the worst. It's the worst insult. You can insult a person with all kinds of words that may get you in legal trouble, because even if you call somebody a liar and he isn't, it can get you in trouble. But if you call somebody a Nazi, which has the most detrimental effect potentially of all the words that people can call you, it never really has an effect, because you can't sue someone. In particular, you know, if you have any leanings or ever said anything that enables people to put you into a Nazi context, whatever you know, broad meaning that has, then you're completely at a loss. And in particular, in German culture, it's even worse. I've seen documentation of if you are not a left winger or an outspoken liberal, but you have any kind of right wing or conservative leanings, even if they're only mild, you can be called a Nazi. There's case law and decisions that were made in Germany saying something to the effect, if you have any kind of leanings that tend toward the right, the public in Germany generally equates anything on the right with Nazi, then you have to just deal with the fact that you're called a Nazi. It's not a libel. And this is, considering the devastating effect this term has on people's life, this is just outrageous. Not that I'm for, you know, enabling people to sue everybody just because they have been called a certain name or whatever. You know, this litigation culture is bad enough as it is. But it shows you how defenseless people are when it comes to this term.
There's a balance in there somewhere. I mean, if you write that down about somebody and that has consequences on their career, which it will if you say that, I think, you know, lawsuits should be fair game, because that's, I mean, you got to do the research, at least, like, ask the person to refute it. You know, if you're writing all this crap about somebody and you're just grabbing it, cut and pasting it from the crap someone else wrote, you got to be more responsible than that. If you're accusing somebody of an a genocidal ideology or something. And it's really amazing, because I see the ones who are pointing the finger at other people and calling them anti-Semitic, not only on this issue, but in contemporary issues about Palestine or something, they'll call people racist and anti-Semitic, while at the same time, they are actually supporting racial apartheid and actual ethnic nepotism themselves. And yet it's all projected on whoever they don't like. And there are really no consequences for it at this point.
Yeah, that's, racism has always been a matter of fashion than it has been of actual stance you have. You can be a black racist, and that, unless you go to extremes with that, that rarely has any consequences. Or, you know, racist, call it racialists, or standing for black identity. Most blacks are proud of their black heritage, or try to be. And there's a lot of pressure within the black community to stay in the black community, and particularly when we're talking about ghettos, ghetto culture, trying to keep people in the ghetto, similar to what Jews had centuries ago, with this shtetl culture, with the Jewish ghetto culture, where rabbis try to keep Jews in the ghetto in order to avoid intermarriage and so forth. We have similar tendencies in the black community at times. And that's considered socially acceptable. At least there's not a big fuss about it. If you had the same kind of stance in parts of the white population, you do, the accusations of racism is there immediately. You know, as a white person, you're expected to intermarry and interbreed with any other color, black, brown, green, milka, pink, whatever it is. And if you have any other stance, I'm for white identity, I want to preserve the identity and culture and whatever, then you're a racist. So there's, it's just not a level playing field in these things. They're weighed with different.
You can have a cultural identity without race too. Like, there's plenty of prejudice between, say, Japanese and Chinese and Koreans, where it's not a racial thing as much as a nationalist thing, but they still, you know, a little bit taboo between marrying each other and stuff, because they want to preserve the culture, even though, regardless, they would be preserving the racial part. But they definitely don't think alike, and so you get the tensions anyway, or British and Irish or something, and a little bit of tension, same race, same language, same religion, still not getting along in some places. So,
well, and not the same religion, you know, Protestants and Catholics, so that's the problem.
Depends which part of Ireland you're talking about, I guess.
Yeah, I remember I was in prison. I had an argument with some prisoners there about identity, and one prisoner said how he wished that all people were finally equal on the whole planet, had the same this, the same that, you know, starting with the skin color and the shape of their eyes and what have you. Everyone's equal, then we don't have the problems anymore with all the tension. And I told him, well, you know, people want to have identity. They don't want to be one equal part of a 7 billion unified mass. Every person looks for their place as an individual, wants to distinguish themselves somehow from others. And then they look for a group they can identify with that sets them apart somehow. And if it's just because you are a fan of this soccer team or that football team, even if everybody would be equal, they were just desperately looking for setting them apart. It's just human nature. You want to be sticking out to some degree, but you also want to be part of a bigger thing that you can identify with that sets you apart from the rest. It's just human nature to...
It's tribalism. Even if you get rid of the biological tribes.
And in the long run...
Arabs.
So... Right. Whatever the line is that's being drawn, to some degree, it's always artificial, because there is no strict dividing line between races either, if there are any races. But that's the definition of the race, that there is no strict line like there is between species. And
you cannot
have
a strict line and still have races too, though.
Right.
It's just not. It just sort of bleeds together, but it doesn't mean it doesn't exist either.
Well, you have, of course, races among horses and dogs and cats, but you don't have them among humans because that's politically incorrect, and that's the only reason why you can't. Of course, it's the same thing. Lines sure. are always arbitrary, but people want to have lines. They want to set themselves apart, and you need to give them a way of living this tendency, this will, in a peaceful way. It's all about being peaceful. You know, as long as you don't kill each other, it's fine with me.
Yeah, it's that simple. But you're an evil Nazi Holocaust denier because you got the wrong scientific results from what they were looking for. It really bothers me the way science is being politicized, not only on this issue, but on a lot of issues across the board, from climate change to gender to what have you. There's a lot of ideological pressure more so than real scientific method going on. But with that, I will close it, and I thank you so much for your time. I'm sorry we had a little hiccup with the audio, but hopefully I can fix that in the editing.
Okay, very good.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having had me.